that the question, what kind of cities do we want to live in? How do we want our cities to be? Cannot be divorced from the question of what kind of people we want to be, what kind of humanity we wish to create amongst ourselves, and how we want to create it. And it is that mutual constitution of the city and who we are and what we are that is something which is, I think, again, very important to reflect upon.
This is The City, an hour dedicated to a critical discussion of urban issues. And welcome to the program here on CITR 101.9 FM and syndicated on CJSF 90.1 FM and available as a podcast at thecityfm.org. I'm Andy Longhurst. On the program, we'll be hearing from Maloon Kothari. He is a former UN Special Rapporteur on the right to adequate housing. And an interesting and important discussion from a global expert on housing and the challenges facing not only developing countries, but certainly Canadian cities as well. You're tuned into The City, an hour dedicated to critical urban discussions. Stay with us. Welcome to the program. This is The City here on CITR 101.9 FM and syndicated on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thanks so much for tuning in. Milun Kuthari is the former UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Adequate Housing, and he spoke at SFU Woodward's on July 9th, 2012. We'll be hearing his full talk titled The Right to Adequate Housing, From Practice to Policy to Practice. I want to thank SFU's Van City Office of Community Engagement for permission to broadcast this recorded talk. And first, we're going to hear UBC Law Professor Margot Young introduce Milun Kuthari, followed by Mr. Kuthari's talk. And this is The City, an hour dedicated to critical urban discussions. Thanks so much for tuning in. And again, the right to adequate housing.
I'm really pleased to be part of tonight's event, and I want to begin by acknowledging that our presence is on the traditional and unceded territories of the Coast Salish people, and to thank them. In 2007, Milun Kuthari, who was then the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing, visited Canada for the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. His visit focused on four specific areas of keen relevance to Canada: homelessness, women's housing rights, housing in Aboriginal peoples, and the possible impact of the then impending 2010 Vancouver Olympics on housing in Vancouver. In the resulting report presented a couple of years later to the United Nations Human Rights Council, Mr. Kuthari noted a couple of several contextual features of housing issues in Canada that remain relevant today. First of all, the report notes that Canadian domestic law at either the constitutional or legislative level does not include explicit recognition of the right to adequate housing as either an enforceable right or a policy commitment. While Canada has signed on to these rights at the international level, such commitments are not enforceable domestically, nor has the Canadian government at any of the levels of Canadian government been particularly successful in voluntary and adequate observance of these international obligations. The report also went on to note the complex system of governance, of shared governance between federal, provincial, and municipal governments that bears on housing matters. This is true particularly for our Indigenous peoples, but also for the immediate local issues of housing that face Vancouver. Canada, furthermore, is one of the few countries in the world without a national housing strategy, at either the federal level or at most provincial levels. The report was, in sum, deeply concerned and critical of the housing situation in Canada. A shortage of social housing stock stood out. Distressing and growing numbers of the homeless were observed in all parts of our country, but severely, particularly in our own downtown east side. Women, especially Aboriginal women, suffered disproportionate poverty and lack of housing affordability and availability. Effective and full government responses to these issues were missing. The result of the 2007 visit and the ensuing report was a series of recommendations for improving the housing situation in Canada. These recommendations emphasize such things as legal recognition of the human right to housing in our legal system, coordinated government housing policy, social housing programs, government coordination and cooperation between levels of government with respect to housing, and engagement with the unique needs of Aboriginal women and with women generally in Canada. 5 years later brings us to today, and homelessness and housing issues remain significant and pressing issues. One in four Canadian households experience a housing adequacy and affordability crisis. Remaining federal commitments to social housing threaten to disappear in a few years. At the municipal level, the situation is no less dire. Vancouver is known as the least affordable city in the world. Property prices skyrocket, rental units are inadequate in number, and out of too many renters' economic ranges. We remain a city where housing availability is shaped by too few housing options and persistent growing unmet demand. Our governments still have yet to step up to these challenges. Yet it is well accepted that affordable, adequate, and accessible housing is a critical social determinant of vital aspects of individual flourishing, of health, of social inclusion, and participation. Housing is also a critical factor in a strong economy, and it's central to a just and equal society. So the challenge remains ours, sadly so, in a country, in a city so prosperous and marked by at least the formal cognizance of the imperative of human rights. We are fortunate to have been able to persuade Maloon to visit us again on this occasion. His wisdom and experience as an outsider who knows us well offer the valuable opportunity for us to engage in the kind of critical, substantive, and in sustained conversation that our aspirations to be a nation and a city that is marked by housing justice necessitate. And I want to end by just reminding you of a few of Maloon's accomplishments. He is an architect by training. He's been a guest professor at a number of universities around the world and is a leading voice at national and international levels on human rights, particularly social and economic rights. As I've already mentioned, he is the past Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing, appointed in 2000 by the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. This was a position that required annual reports to the Commission and then the Human Rights Council on the status of housing rights throughout the world. He is currently coordinator of the South Asian Regional Program of the Habitat International Coalition's Housing and Land Rights Network, and he is a founding member of the International NGO Committee on Human Rights in Trade and Investment. We're fortunate tonight to have as the central feature of the events that lie before us a presentation by Maloon. This will be followed by a short series of comments by Michael Shapcott, who's going to zoom in via Skype to us from Toronto. And Michael is the director of the Wellesley Institute, and I'll provide a bit more information about him before he appears on the large screen. After that, there'll be a short conversation between Maloon, Michael, and myself, and we'll follow that by an opportunity for questions from the audience, and hoping that we'll wrap this event up at about 9 o'clock. So all that's left for me then is simply to ask you to join me in welcoming Maloon Kothari back to Vancouver, to this stage, and to join again in conversation with us. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Margot, and good evening, everyone. It's wonderful to be back. I got a bit emotional when you were introducing me. I almost feel like it's a second home. I've been here so often recently. But it's good to be back. It's very disturbing to see that not much has changed on the housing front, but we have to keep on with our work. Before I begin, let me also acknowledge that we are here in the traditional territories of Tsleil-Waututh Saawasee. Apologies for not pronouncing it properly. All of you are probably wondering that someone who's been around for so long and been to so many places couldn't think of a more creative title to this evening's lecture. But let me try to explain that. What I'm going to try to do over the next half an hour, 40 minutes, is trace for you the history of the right to adequate housing, how it has developed, how it was actually civil society movements and campaigns that articulated what the right meant, and then that was taken up by different bodies in the United Nations, and then that articulation is now you know, part of policy and law in different countries in the world, and one of the reasons why what comes from the United Nations, as has been my experience, resonates very well with civil society groups and campaigns is because the language, the ideas have actually come from the grassroots, and I think that's very, very important for us to acknowledge. So the right to housing, the history actually begins in 1948 with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which acknowledged housing, right to housing, as part of a right to an adequate standard of living. And this was followed subsequently by the recognition of the right in the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights in 1966. In the Convention on Rights of the Child, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, and most recently, the Convention on the rights of disabled peoples. And this right has, through the years, been developed by different bodies that monitor the implementation of these instruments that I'm mentioning. During the 70s and 80s, there was also work done on the right to housing through national courts. In particular, I'd like to mention the Indian Supreme Court, which in a series of judgments in the 70s and 80s said that the right to life includes the right to housing. They made a link between the struggle for a place to live and the right to life. And during the same time, there were international NGOs. There was an effort being made here in Canada, actually, which preceded the first global conference on human settlements, Habitat One, in 76, which then led to the formation of an international coalition, Habitat International Council at that time. And then there was very active work done, again, in the 70s and 80s by national campaigns around the world. I'll give you one example, the National Campaign on Housing Rights in India, which did an extensive survey of what housing meant in the country at the vernacular, at the local level. And you know, the understanding was that for most people, housing is much more than four walls and a roof. It's actually a place to live, a place to belong. And that articulation was then, that was sent up to the UN Committee on Economic and Social and Cultural Rights, which drafted something called a general comment, which was a legal interpretation of the right to housing in the covenant. And in the general comment, the committee acknowledged that the right to adequate housing should not be interpreted narrowly as a right to basic shelter or a roof over one's head, but rather, and I quote, as a right to live somewhere in security, peace, and dignity. And then the comment clarified that the right to housing is integrally linked to other human rights and to the inherent dignity of the human person. The comment went on to elaborate on seven what they called essential elements of the right to housing, without any of those, the right to housing is not would not be considered to have been met or implemented. These were the legal security of tenure, availability of services, materials, facilities, and infrastructure, the question of affordability, the question of habitability, that housing had to be habitable, accessibility, location, the question of where it's located in terms of access to employment opportunities, health, education, and cultural adequacy. And this was the first attempt at the global level to actually explain what just a few words mean in the covenants and the conventions. After the committee drafted this recommendation, there was more work done at national levels, at global levels, which led actually to the recognition, the very strong and detailed recognition of the right to adequate housing in the Habitat Agenda, which is the document that came out of the second global, second World Conference on Human Settlements in 1996 in Istanbul. And then during that time, increasingly we saw the recognition in national constitutions. The South African Constitution in 1996 recognized housing as a fundamental right, a justiciable right. And the article that recognizes that says that everyone has the right to have access to adequate housing, and the state must take reasonable legislative and other measures to achieve this right. And third, no one may be evicted from their home or have their home demolished without an order of court made after considering all the relevant circumstances, and no legislation may permit arbitrary evictions. I know many of you wish you had this kind of a recognition in your own charter, but it's interesting that there are countries in the South that have increasingly recognized that. Most recently, the Kenyan constitution has a similar provision. Just now, the finalization of the constitution in Nepal has a similar provision, which recognizes housing not as a sort of we call a directive principle or something to aspire to, but as a fundamental human right equal to all other human rights. So in the year 2000, when the Commission on Human Rights at that time decided to appoint a special rapporteur on housing, one of the driving forces was the dire situation in the world. At that time, the statistics were horrifying. 100 million people homeless in the world, 20 to 40 million in urban areas, and 1.6 billion people considered inadequately housed by the UN. That plus many submissions from civil society organizations around the world convinced the Commission on Human Rights, and what is now called the Human Rights Council, is the highest intergovernmental policymaking body on human rights in the UN. So that convinced the Commission to appoint, for the first time, a special rapporteur on adequate housing to understand the scale of the problem and to make recommendations. So I was appointed in the year 2000. And when I began my work, just based on what had happened in the preceding 10 and 15 years, and I had been part of a lot of that, I reinterpreted the work on the right to housing to actually go even beyond where the other human rights bodies, like the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, had gone in their understanding of the right to housing. And what prompted me to do this was the firm recognition from my own experience that the right to housing is not just, as is articulated in the Covenant on Economic, Social, just the economic, social, and cultural rights, but it has many, many dimensions of civil and political rights. So in the interest of what is called the indivisibility of rights, human rights, it was clear that the right to housing cannot be separated from the right to security of the home, security of the person, freedom from inhuman and degrading treatment, freedom of movement, and so on. So taking into account the work that had been done until that time and this recognition of the right to adequate housing as a sort of comprehensive and holistic right, I attempted right at the beginning of the mandate to just to put out a sort of definition of how we should understand the right to housing. And the definition said, and I'm quoting, that the human right to adequate housing is the right of every woman, man, youth, and child to gain and sustain a secure place to live in peace and dignity. So the idea was to capture the entire spectrum of what the right to housing means. And in doing that, in the subsequent years, I attempted to expand the elements that the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights had identified. And I included elements such as freedom from dispossession, damage, and destruction, access to land, water, and natural resources, access to information, participation, the right to resettle and restitution, the right to privacy and security, and the right to access to remedies, and the right to education and empowerment. So you can see it was the initial attempt in the initial years of the mandate was to open up the issue to see what kind of responses were received from different sectors of society around the world. And I'm happy to report that during the course of the eight-year mandate, this interpretation of the right to housing was accepted by everyone. I don't think anyone really challenged that. There were some governments that said I was exceeding my mandate, but I took that as a compliment and I just continued.
And this is The City here on CITR 101.9 FM and syndicated on CJSF 90.1 FM and available as a podcast at thecityfm.org. I'm Andy Longhurst, and you're tuned into a conversation or a talk by Maloon Kothari, and he is the former UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Adequate Housing, and he spoke at SFU Woodward's on July 9th, 2012. And his talk is entitled The Right to Adequate Housing, From Practice to Policy to Practice. And we're going to continue hearing from Mr. Kothari in the second half of the hour. Thanks for tuning in. This is The City, an hour dedicated to critical urban discussions.
So during the course of those 8 years, I also identified based on, I carried out 13 country missions, one of them was here in Canada, and visited a number of other countries, and I produced 8 annual reports which looked at different themes on the right to housing. And in that work, I identified a number of key obstacles to the realization of the right to adequate housing, and these are still with us. First was the issue of forced evictions. I found during the course of the work that actually millions of people around the world were being displaced from their homes for a range of reasons, but most disturbingly for development purposes, for large-scale development projects, for large-scale infrastructure projects, city beautification, mega, you know, sports events. And shockingly, one of the statistics that we came up with was that actually annually in the world, more people were being displaced from their homes because of, you know, ostensibly development than because of armed and ethnic conflict, which is quite a, you know, significant finding. And we found that most of the people who were being evicted, there was no prior notice, there was very little consultation. There was inadequate or no resettlement. So essentially, it was the direct result of that was the growth of homelessness around the world, the growth of slums around the world, and that many of the evictions were increasingly taking place because of market-based solutions, that it was actually speculation in rent, land and property, the lack of rental protection legislation, and generally the sort of prominence or the preeminence given to markets by governments that was leading to people being displaced from their homes. The second main obstacle, of course, was homelessness itself, the growth of homelessness, the lack of governments to actually understand homelessness. I found very few governments that had an accurate assessment of how many people were homeless in their country, very few governments that had an appropriate definition of what is homelessness. The third area, which actually I was able to study in great detail, was the issue of women's rights to housing and land, property, and inheritance. The Commission on Human Rights asked me, alongside my regular work, to actually produce a separate study on women's rights to housing and land. And we did a 4-year study that resulted in 3 reports. And many regional consultations where we heard across the world voices of women at the grassroots. There was also a consultation held in the United States which included women here from Canada. And some of the main findings of that 4-year study were that, first was that I was quite shocked by the fact that there was a culture of silence when it came to women's rights to housing and land. There was no participation of women in housing, planning, you know, other related policies. There was never any consent of women to the development policies. The second was that the ironic fact that while women's rights were being recognized more and more in law and policy, the at the same time, the implementation was not there. So essentially there was a huge gap between recognition and implementation. The third was the growing incidence of violence against women. And this was across the world. In fact, there are very disturbing statistics of domestic violence in Western Europe. The whole issue of violence and violence also because of women being evicted from their homes and facing insecure conditions and a range of other reasons. The fourth finding was that there are, when it concerns women's rights to housing, land, property, and inheritance, many countries that have conflicting legal regimes. So there are formal laws, there are religious laws, there are customary laws, and very little attempt being made to harmonize them consistent with international human rights recognition and law. And the other finding was that women suffered greatly because of multiple forms of discrimination. When I was on mission in Australia, I'll give you an example. I I met a lady who was indigenous, an elderly indigenous leader who was disabled. And when she explained to me the obstacles that she faces on a daily basis, it became very clear that unless we have data and information at this type of disaggregated level, it's very difficult to think about what types of policy interventions are necessary to help people who have women who suffer from multiple forms of discrimination. So that brings me to the other finding that was what surprised me when I was traveling around the world was generally a lack of assessment. I mentioned homelessness, but it was not only homelessness, a lack of assessment of the scale of the housing problem. First of all, I found that very few countries, as I mentioned, knew how many people were homeless, how many people were being displaced from their homes, how much land was being grabbed, there were no definitions to try to understand this. The second was that there was a lack of disaggregated data. So if you look at homeless people, how many women are homeless, how many Aboriginal people are homeless, how many children are homeless, this type of disaggregated data was, continues to actually not be, there isn't an accurate assessment of that. Nor was there an assessment of the type of changes happening in cities. I mean, across the world, we've had this phenomenon of ghettoization, of segregation of communities, the building of what I've been calling apartheid cities, towns, and villages. And that type of spatial data, which would show you, you know, which parts of the city who lives, was very much missing, particularly tracked over time, what the statistics people call time series data. The third finding was that where there was information available, there was a lack of analysis of that information. So very often in many countries, I found that the statistical institutes or the census bureaus had information, but it was not used for policy. So there was just not enough understanding of the data that was available, and it was not, and even the data that was available was not used for policy formulation. The fourth finding, which I'll come back to, because I think this is very significant, was of course that one of the reasons there wasn't an accurate estimate is because a lot of energy went into what I call the obsession with growth and obsession with economic policies. So it was housing, and housing for the vulnerable was always seen as a something that you have to do after the fact, sort of a band-aid thing or something, simply a welfare or a humanitarian measure. So lack of assessment and scale of the problem. This issue of growing speculation of land and property, no regulation or rules, very few rules for real estate developers, a great deal of corruption in the procurement of property. There's a growth of land mafias and cartels across the world, which include politicians, which include elected officials, which include bureaucrats. And therefore, there's little interest in meeting the housing needs of the vulnerable and the poor. There was also growing privatization as a result of global economic and other policies. Privatization of civic services, water, electricity, so on. And I found that in one of the reports I did on the impact of global policies on housing, that privatization, there were actually three primary lessons that can be drawn from experience with privatization. One is that private businesses put too much emphasis on profits and cost recovery. It's not surprising. And privatization often leads to rate increases. Second, that service to vulnerable groups of parts of the cities, towns where vulnerable people live is inadequate and of poor quality. And many of the poor in many cities of the world, including in my own country, end up paying something 20 times more than the rich for water. And the third is that privatization reduces the accountability and local control because multinational corporations which lead these privatization schemes and projects are accountable to their shareholders and not to the citizens in the countries where they operate. So this whole issue of you know, the obsession with the market, if countries followed the right to adequate housing approach, what they would do is regulate the market, they would control speculation, actively intervene in the market, build social housing, have strong rental legislation, regulate banks and the whole process of mortgages, address housing subsidies for the poor, and create housing options and the whole concept of the housing continuum, which I will come back to. Instead, what we saw and we continue to see is increasing deregulation of the real estate market, the weakening of rent control legislations, the demolition of public housing, reduction of subsidies, increased, you know, sort of places where there are 40-year mortgages, and essentially this obsession with home ownership, as if that's the only solution to the housing problem. And in a sense, when we look at the current economic crisis around the world, it's very interesting to see that the solutions that are being proposed come from that same neoliberal mindset. So the banks that have got us into these problems are the ones that are being bailed out, and there's something terribly wrong with that. So that's sort of just a quick overview of the work and the main findings of the mandate. I'll just spend some few more minutes on, so what is to be done? Where is the hope faced with such a huge scale of problems? And within the mandate from the Human Rights Commission and the Council, one of the tasks I was able to complete was to prepare what are now called the United Nations Basic Principles and Guidelines on Development-Based Displacement and Evictions. The idea was to prepare a set of guidelines, sort of operational guidelines that would indicate to municipalities and other levels of government the human rights safeguards that had to be put into place before, during, and after displacement, after evictions. So the guidelines attempt to give a definition. They say that, you know, evictions can only happen in exceptional circumstances, that there has to be adequate information, consultation, consent. There have to be eviction impact assessments. There has to be a right of people who are living in dangerous conditions to resettle, and there has to be adequate compensation. And the guidelines also, and this is, I think, for the first time in the UN that we have guidelines that that say that states states are asked to take specific preventative measures to avoid, and I'm reading directly, avoid and or eliminate underlying causes of forced evictions, such as speculation in land and real estate. States should review the operation and regulation of the housing and tenancy markets, and when necessary, intervene to ensure that market forces do not increase the vulnerability of low-income and other marginalized groups to forced evictions. And I think you can probably identify with this very much here in Vancouver. And the guidelines go on in great detail to talk about other safeguards that are necessary, other preventative measures that that have to be taken. The other recommendations that came out of the mandate, which can be helpful, is that, and it leads from what I was saying earlier about the lack of an assessment of the scale of the problem, was how do you actually make a better assessment, and what would that achieve, and what would that achieve, particularly in terms of holding the state accountable for the policies and for lack of policies and legislations, and how an accurate assessment would actually allow us to counter government propaganda that is there around the world that actually neoliberal policies work for the poor. There's this belief without any evidence that rising tide lifts all boats, that there's a trickle-down effect, and all of that. So there were a number of recommendations on carrying out assessments and what that would achieve. The other idea which appealed to me very much and which I mentioned in many different parts of the world actually comes from Canada. It's the idea of the housing continuum, that in any city you have to have a gradation of options for housing. You cannot only have shelters, a little bit of rental, and then mostly, you know, home ownership. You have to have supportive housing. You have to have hostels where necessary. You have to have different forms of rental housing, cooperative housing, and so on. And unless you do this, you're not actually following a rights approach. And the other idea I wanted to share with you, and I think this is perhaps one of the most promising sort of concepts and now, you know, being put into action that has come out of the work on housing and other areas, is the whole concept of the right to the city. Essentially, the idea is very simple. It is that everyone who contributes through their work to a city, a city's economy, a city's, you know, culture, social life, has the right to everything that city has to offer. I mean, that's essentially, in a few words, the concept. But the work that has been done in the recent years on interpreting the right to the city from a sort of overall human rights perspective is that we have to go beyond just the recognition of the right to the city that, you know, guarantees that, to guarantee that all human rights to all those living and seeking to live in city spaces, with a special focus on marginalized and vulnerable groups, and that the right to the city needs to encompass the ideals of an alternative, adequate, and ideal city, that it should encompass the principles of the indivisibility of rights, that the rights should be, there should be guaranteed to all women and men, youth and children who, irrespective of their economic status or identity, class, caste, and that there was a need for inclusive models of mixed-use city planning and development. The priority has to be given to vulnerable and marginalized groups, and there's a very good example of this in the form of a national legislation called the Right to the City legislation in Brazil, which is a legislation which actually calls on municipalities to designate what the law says are zones of social interest. So areas where vulnerable people live would be given special recognition. The people there living there, the communities, would be given security of tenure and provided with civic services. So the right to the city has actually received that type of legal recognition, at least in one country. The right to the city also includes the need for gendered cities and gender equality, the need for participation of everyone in the type of development that takes place. And very importantly, something that's a little bit complex, the terminology, but it would also include the right to non-retrogression, which essentially means that any advance that has been made in a city in terms of provision of social housing, in terms of, you know, protection of tenants, cannot be clawed back. So you cannot retreat from that. And if you do, then it would be a violation of the obligations that the city has. So, in a sense, the right to the city calls for the implementation of international human rights commitments. It calls for the harmonization of local and national laws with international standards. It calls for human rights-based reform of city policies and its development paradigm. And it calls for implementation of regulatory measures, what I was saying before, to check the unfettered growth of the market. So essentially, the right to the city as a concept encompassing a range of a bundle of human rights can become, and this is being picked up by movements around the world, very actively the work has gone on in Latin America, but it's also now being picked up in Africa and Asia. So the concept can become a powerful organizing principle for mobilization and advocacy. So the idea of the right to the city, I think Margot has summarized the recommendations that I wanted to actually end with this, recommendations I made in my mission report to Canada, but let me just spend a few minutes on that. The overarching recommendation was that Canada has to adopt a comprehensive and coordinated national housing strategy based on the recognition of the right to housing, that it has to give full legal recognition to the right to adequate housing. When I made my assessment, I couldn't think of another solution but that Canada has to embark on a large-scale program of building social housing, as it was doing in the 70s and 80s. And that there has to be a range of sort of measures taken, measurable goals and timetables for the achievement of housing for the most vulnerable. And there was a need. I found the framework of tenant protection law was largely missing. And of course, very important, the development of a targeted Aboriginal housing strategy. My conclusions, which actually Margot summarized, was that there was a serious crisis of homelessness and inadequate housing in Canada, and it was really surprising for me to see that in such a wealthy country there are such levels of inadequacy in housing, homelessness, and a range of other problems. So finally, I think that. I wanted to speak a little bit more, but perhaps this can come up in discussion. I feel that the obstacles that we face are tremendous around the world, and we need to take all measures. We need to use the UN system as it is there. We need to go out on the street if possible. We need to there has to be much more mobilization on the issue of housing. And I wanted to end by reciting a small poem from Sudhir, from Sahir Ludhianvi, who's a very famous historically an Urdu poet from my part of the world, from the Indian subcontinent. And this might sound a bit, very sort of perhaps too strong for you, but from in many parts of the world, it carries a deep resonance. And I quote, "If we fail to speak up today, deadly silence we will earn. Every home will be on fire. Every dwelling we'll see burn. From beyond the silence, then, a cry of anguish will return. There's no one here, no one at all, no one." So I think we all need to work in our own spaces across countries and internationally to try to bring the right to adequate housing to a reality for vulnerable people who are all around us. Thank you very much.
and a track from Language Arts and off their new release, Wonderkind. I'm Andy Longhurst, and this is The City and Hour, dedicated to critical urban discussions. And on the hour, you've been hearing from Miloun Kothari, and he is a former UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Adequate Housing. And that was from a talk he gave on July 9th, 2012 at SFU Woodwards. And I want to, again, thank the SFU Vancity Office of Community Engagement for permission to broadcast that recorded talk. And if you missed any part of that, you can certainly check that out at thecityfm.org. And we're here on 101.9 FM CITR and syndicated on CJSF 90.1 FM. And again, as I mentioned, you can check out the podcast of this show as a podcast and also of past shows at thecityfm.org. And you can catch The City live here on CITR Tuesdays at 5 p.m. and syndicated on CJSF Fridays at 10 a.m. And be sure to follow The City on Twitter with the handle thecity_FM and on Facebook by searching The City Critical Urban Discussions. And thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll be back next week with more critical urban discussions. Enjoy that sunshine out there. Take care.